Welcome back, Hemming Brainiacs, to the Hemming Brainiacathon podcast of excellence, where we will be talking about The Red and the Black, Book 1, Chapter 21, Part 2, the second half. It's actually more like the second two-thirds of the chapter. Louise, that's Madame de Renal, seems excited by this scheming. Sofiati said she does, and Julian seems aroused by Louise's ability to scheme. Yeah, there was something a bit off, wasn't there, about how giddy they both seemed to get about sort of getting away with it and all the plotting and scheming. You'd think, maybe it is because of the awareness of the stakes. Because they're both screwed if they get found out. Like, if the accusation actually gets confirmed, they're screwed. Julian and Louise. Are they not? So maybe this a sense of that danger is what's giving him the giddiness, and maybe even a little bit of like a sort of denial of that danger.
There's another half to that comment. Sofiati said, out of curiosity, what are the dashed names about? Marquise de R dash and the King of dash.
Yeah, there's been a bit of that happening. I don't know why. Laura Y. Stitch says, you'll see that all the time in classics with dates as well. It's because the author doesn't want to be accused of writing about a real person or a real event in a fictitious novel. Sofiati says, that makes sense. Thanks. Okay, so they didn't want to say the King of Scotland because they didn't want people to think, oh, who was the King of Scotland at that time, and that's who they're writing about. It was a fictional king of it doesn't matter where, because they're not real, right? Is that kind of makes sense. That's not a bad way to go about doing that. And the Marquise D.R. dash. Yeah, I suppose, again, they didn't... I mean, with that one, couldn't you just... Oh, wait, what does Marquise mean? Is that like... Is that a title? Is that like saying the king of something? I'm not really sure. Anyway, that makes sense. By the way, tonight's episode of this podcast is brought to you by an instant cappuccino. Oh yeah, by the way, isolation update. My espresso machine that I panic bought back in early March before lockdown happened, and used at least twice a day since then, it became faulty. It stopped working properly. So I troubleshot it, followed the recommended actions for the problem I was having. Did not work, so I took it down for a replacement because I had a warranty, and they were out of stock. So they refunded it instead, which is fine. You know, I'm back to square one. That's fine. But now I don't have my awesome coffee machine, which was, just going to put this out there, it was like the highlight of my days in isolation so far, was the fact that I could still make myself a really good espresso. And so, yeah, now I'm back to instant coffee for now, until they get some more stock back in. So that's my isolation update for you. Very exciting. Sorry, that story about me having a coffee machine went for ages. all right. Sofiati also said, a small quarter of the way rant. All right, I love a good rant. Let's go. The Red and the Black sounds its age. I understand it is old, having been published in 1830 and all. It is really old, isn't it? That's significantly older than our, our Tolstoy books that we've read and our Dostoevsky books that we've read. Tolstoy's ones being from the kind of later 1800s. They're a good 50 years newer, which is significant, really. So I hadn't kind of considered that until now. But in my head, it seems even older than that. As I read it, French porcelain figures with knee-high socks, high-heeled shoes, and white wigs pop into my head, I've recently read Northanger Abbey, published in 1818, and it didn't read as old and stifled. All the parts that could be relatable, Julian's young ambition, local politics, classism, and Louise's torment, are just a tad too removed. It's all under a thin layer of mould, and I can't fully empathise. I wonder how I will feel by the end of the book. Is this sentiment due to Stendhal not quite putting a finger on what is at the core of common humanity? I haven't made up my mind yet. Well, that's interesting you say that. I find the prose style doesn't seem that much more dated than, say, War and Peace. I compare it to War and Peace specifically because they're both set at around the same time. Even though War and Peace is 50 years newer, it's set at the early 1800s. So it's a good comparison because then you can get an idea of what language is modern from the author's point of view versus what's modern or what's era appropriate, I suppose. But I found the prose pretty readable. I do understand, I feel you as well with the whole relatability and that kind of sort of feeling of a bit removed from the characters. The thin layer of mould, as you put it. Altreat said, it's hard to say, and probably people will feel differently on this. Personally, I really like this book, and it's by far the most enjoyable one I've read with this group so far, so taste is definitely a factor. I also think it's important to remember that the subtitle is A Chronicle of 1830. It is supposed to be situated firmly in its place and time. And although we share a common humanity, it can look and feel differently in different times. European soldiers in World War I and pre-World War I had a different idea of what honour looked like and how to embody it than European soldiers fighting in World War II and after, although both wanted to behave with honour. We live in a different world than Julian, so certain perceptions have changed and certain markers that really meant something in that time may no longer mean what they once did. But to me, I don't think that necessarily means Stendhal didn't capture common humanity, but I also have to say that I don't know how well he did capture it. I guess I don't really have a strong opinion on it. We still have a way, long way to go. Would love to hear others' views as well. I'm enjoying this book too, and I agree that it's one of my more preferred ones so far in the Hemingway list. My favourites being... my favourites actually being the two Stephen Crane ones, the short stories, The Open Boat and The Blue Hotel. Funnily enough, I think I liked that they were light-hearted and they weren't love triangles and they weren't like overly kind of political or overly spiritual. They were just like an adventure at sea, you know, or an adventure with some card players in a hotel, you know. I liked those. But no, I am really enjoying this book too. What was I going to say? What was my point there? What were we talking about? The common humanity. One thing I did find relatable is Julian's volatility, or his... No, not volatility. His kind of rashness, I suppose. His... young and hot-headed. And I remember feeling that way. I remember being that way at about that age, you know, 18, 19, venturing off into the world and going a million different ways at once. And every time you turn and try something different, you're kind of convinced that you're invincible in some way. You know, in a lot of ways, you're very kind of self-conscious and nervous, not nervous, but, you know, unsure about the world. But also you are quite convinced that you're invincible in some ways as well. Strange feeling to be a young man. All right. There's a conversation. We've had a conversation. I think let's read another chapter. Let me just... flick open this book here, have a look how long it is. Well, it's an interesting title for the chapter. Oh, it's another. Oh, it's another longy. Oh, it keeps going. There's another page turn. Okay. It's an 11 pager. So, we're going to have to do another halfie. We're going to have to do another halfie because I'm not reading 11 pages. That's madness. All right. All right, we're going to read up to, it's about halfway through, so about five pages in, when it says, it was Madame de Renal who had come to town on a visit. All right, up until Madame de Renal comes to town on a visit. That's when we're going to stop. All right, very good. Sorry about the halfie. But, yeah, I think this whole experience goes a bit smoother when we read about sort of up to five or six or so pages. And when we go up past sort of 10, the thing I've noticed in the past and people who've been involved for a few books, on really long chapters, there's tends to be nearly no discussion. And it's the weirdest thing. You'd think you'd have a lot more to discuss because you've read more pages, but it just doesn't seem to work that way. If we read 10 pages today, tomorrow's conversation will have one or two comments. And also not to mention that it just makes it a bit more doable for me to do a daily podcast if I'm not reading for too long. That's my phone buzzing. Ignore that. All right. Chapter 22 is called Modes of Behavior in 1830. And it's funny because this is actually set about 15 years after War and Peace is set. And now I'm realizing that it actually does read as more old-fashioned than War and Peace. And that might be because it was written before War and Peace, even though it's set after it. Worlds have been given to man to hide his thoughts. Sorry, read that wrong. Words have been given to man to hide his thoughts. R.P. Malagrida. Hardly had Julian arrived at Verrieres than he reproached himself for his injustice to Madame de Renal. I would have felt contempt for her as a poor little woman if through weakness she had failed in her scene with Monsieur de Renal, but she conducts herself like a statesman, and then I go and sympathize with the loser, who is my enemy. That's bourgeois pettiness for you. My vanity is shocked because Madame de Renal is a man. That huge and illustrious company to which I have the honor to belong, I am no better than a fool. Monsieur Chalan had refused all the lodgings that the most prominent liberals in the district had vied with one another to offer him when his dismissal had driven him from the presbytery. The two rooms he had rented were encumbered with his books. Julian, wishing to demonstrate to Verrieres what it is to be a priest, went to fetch a dozen planks of pine from his father's place, which he then carried on his own back down the length of the main street. He borrowed some tools from an old schoolfellow and had soon put up a sort of bookcase in which he arranged Monsieur Chalan's books. "I thought that you had been corrupted by the vanity of the world," said the old man, weeping with joy. "This is something that does much to redeem the childish vanity of the ostentation's guard of honour uniform, which made you so many enemies." Monsieur de Renal had ordered Julian to stay at his house. Nobody suspected what had happened. The third day after his arrival, Julian witnessed no less a personage than Monsieur, the sub-prefect of Moiron, climb right up to his room. It was not until 2 hours of insipid chit-chat and lengthy jeremiads, on the wickedness of men, on the lack of probity to be found in those individuals in charge of public funds, on the dangers of this to poor France, etc., etc., that Julian began to see the point of the visit. They were already on the landing, and the poor, semi-disgraced tutor was ushering out with appropriate respect the prefect-to-be of some happy department or another. when it pleased the latter to concern himself about Julian's career and to praise his moderation as regards his own advancement, etc., etc. At last, Monsieur de Moiron, squeezing his arm in the most paternal manner, proposed to him that he should leave Monsieur de Renal and go into the household of an official who had children to acculturate, and who, like King Philip, thanked heaven, not that they had been given to him, but that they had been born in the vicinity of Monsieur Julian. Their tutor would enjoy 800 francs in salary, payable not month by month, which is not aristocratic, said Monsieur de Moiron, but quarterly and always in advance. It was Julian's turn. He had waited, though, through an hour and a half of tedium to speak. His response was perfect, and above all, as drawn out as a pastoral homily. He let everything be understood, yet said nothing plainly. In his speech there was to be found respect for Monsieur de Renal, deference to the public Verrieres, and gratitude to the illustrious sub-prefect. The said sub-prefect, astonished to find a greater Jesuit than himself, tried in vain to obtain something concrete. Julian, delighted, jumped at the opportunity to practice his skills and began to reply again in different terms. Never did an eloquent minister, wishing to use up the last period of a session when the chamber seems to be starting to rouse itself, say less in so great a number of words. Scarcely had Monsieur de Moiron left than Julian started to laugh like a wild thing. To take advantage of this surge of Jesuitical verve, he wrote a 9-page letter to Monsieur de Renal in which he told him all that had been said to him, and humbly solicited advice. That joker didn't even give me the name of whoever made the offer. It will be Monsieur Valenod interpreting my exile to Verrieres as the effect of his anonymous letter. His missive dispatched Julian happy as a hunter marching into a plain full of game at 6 in the morning on a fine autumn day, went out to ask counsel of Monsieur Chelan, but before he had arrived at the good cure's room, heaven, which seemed intent on bringing him joy, threw Monsieur Valenod under his feet. Monsieur Valenod, to whom he did not conceal the fact that his heart was desolate, a poor boy such as himself should devote himself wholly to the vocation that heaven had vouchsafed his heart. But in this base world, vocation was not all. To cultivate the Lord's vineyard with propriety, and not to be unworthy of a multitude of learned fellow labourers, instruction was necessary. It was essential to spend 2 expensive years at the seminary at Besançon. Excuse me. It was therefore indispensable to make savings, which was easier with 800 francs paid quarterly than with 600 francs which ate themselves up month on month. On the other hand, was it not the case that heaven, in placing him beside the issue of a Renal, and above all, in inspiring in him a special attachment for them, was it not that heaven seemed to direct that it was not meant to be that he should abandon this educational task for another? Julian attained such a degree of perfection in this kind of eloquence, which has replaced the decisive action of the empire, that he ended up by boring himself with the sound of his own voice. On arriving back, he found one of Monsieur Valenod's footmen in elaborate livery, who had been looking for him throughout the town with a card inviting him to lunch the same day. Never before had Julian been in this man's house. Only a few days previously he had been thinking of little else but how to assail him with a flurry of blows with a cane while avoiding police prosecution. Although lunch was not scheduled until 1 o'clock, Julian felt it would seem more respectful to present himself from 12:30 onwards in the workroom of Monsieur the director of the poorhouse. He found the latter parading his own importance amid a mass of dispatch boxes. His huge black whiskers, his enormous amount of hair, his smoking cap worn askew on the top of his head, his vast pipe, his embroidered trousers, the chunky gold chains crossed every which way on his chest, all these appurtenances of a provincial money man who fancies himself a ladies man, did not impress Julian at all. He thought only the more of the caning he owed him. He requested the honour of being presented to Madame Valenod. She was at her toilet and could not receive him.
By way of compensation, he had the privilege of assisting at that of Monsieur the director of the poorhouse. They then proceeded to Madame Valenod's quarters, where she introduced her children with tears in her eyes. This lady, one of the most respected in Verrières, had a large manly countenance to which she had applied rouge for the great occasion. She displayed a world of maternal feeling. Julien thought of Madame de Renal. His habitual mistrustfulness meant that he was susceptible only to that sort of nostalgia evoked by contrast, but here he was seized with it to the point of tears. The mood was increased by the sight of the director of the poorhouse's mansion. He was given the tour. Everything there was magnificent and new, and one was told the price of each article of furniture. Julien found something ignoble in all of this, smelling of misappropriated funds. Everyone down, even to the servants, had an air of putting on confident looks in order to avert contempt. The inspector of taxes, the officer of indirect taxation, the head of the gendarmerie, and two or three other public officials arrived accompanied by their wives. They were followed by a selection of wealthy liberals. Lunch was announced. It occurred to Julien, already in a terrible mood, that on the other side of the dining room wall might be found poor people shut up there whose helping of meat had perhaps been siphoned off. That was my phone, ignore that. To pay for all this luxurious bad taste that was supposed to bowl him over. Perhaps they are going hungry at this very moment, he said to himself. His throat tightened. He found it impossible to eat, almost impossible to speak. It was much worse a few minutes later. In the distance there could be heard snatches of a popular and, it must be admitted, rather coarse song being sung by one of the inmates. Monsieur Valenod glanced at one of his men in magnificent livery who went out, and soon there was no more singing to be heard. At that moment a footman offered Julien some Rhine wine in a green glass, and Madame Valenod was careful to tell him that it cost 9 francs a bottle from the makers. Julien, holding out his green glass, said to Monsieur Valenod, "They're not singing that low song any longer." "Good Lord, I should think not," cried the director triumphantly. "I've had the scroungers silenced." This reply was too much for Julien. He had the manners of his station in life, but not yet in sensibility. Despite his so frequent rehearsed hypocrisy, he felt a large tear flow down his cheek. He attempted to hide it with a green glass, but that made it impossible for him to do justice to the Rhine wine. "To stop the man singing," he said to himself, "O dear God, and thou sufferest this." Luckily, no one noticed the sentimentality in such poor taste. The inspector of taxes had struck up a royalist song. During the din of the refrain sung in chorus, Julian's conscience said to him, "Here, then, is the filthy good fortune that is coming to you, and you will enjoy it only in these conditions and in company like this. Perhaps you will get a post worth 20,000 francs, but that means that while you gorge yourself with food, you will stop a pathetic prisoner song. You will give dinners with the money you have filched from his miserable allowance, and during your dinner he will be even more wretched. Oh, Napoleon, in your day, how sweet it was to rise to fortune through the dangers of battle, but to heap up the sufferings of the poor in this low way. I confess that the weakness displayed by Julien in this soliloquy gives me a poor opinion of him. He was fit to be classed with those yellow-gloved conspirators who pretend to alter the whole manner of arranging affairs in a great country, but do not want to have reproach themselves with making the slightest scratch. Julien was rudely recalled to his role. It was not to muse and say nothing that he had been invited to dine in such good company. A retired painted cloth manufacturer, a corresponding member of the Academy at Besançon and of the Uzès, addressed a question to him from one end of the table to the other, asking if that was commonly said about his amazing progress in the New Testament studies were true. Suddenly a profound silence reigned. A Latin New Testament found itself, as if by magic, in the hand of the learned member of the two academies. On Julian's response, a half verse in Latin was read at random. He recited on from there. His memory proved faithful,
and the marvel was applauded with all the boisterous energy of a table at the end of a dinner. Julian looked round the glowing faces of the ladies. Many of them were not unattractive. He picked out the wife of the melodious tax inspector. "Verily, I am ashamed to speak in Latin for so long in front of the ladies," he said, gazing at her. "If Monsieur Rubigno, the member of the two academies, would have the goodness to read out a Latin phrase at random, I will attempt, instead of responding with the ensuing Latin text, to construct an impromptu translation." This second test crowned him with glory. There were numerous wealthy men there who were liberals, but who, as happy fathers, qualified to obtain scholarships, had suddenly become converts since the last mission. Despite this subtle political move, Monsieur de Renault had not been willing to receive them in his house. These fine men, who knew Julian only by reputation and by having seen him on horseback at the entry of the King of Dash, were his most clamorous admirers. "When will these idiots leave off wanting to hear biblical language in which they understand nothing?" he wondered. But on the contrary, the style amused them by its strangeness. They laughed at it. It was Julian who became tired. He gravely rose as 6 o'clock sounded, mentioning a chapter of Ligorio's New Theology that he must learn by heart by tomorrow in order to recite it to Monsieur Chelan. "For my calling," he added pleasantly, "is to make people recite lessons and then recite them myself." There was much laughter, much admiration. The king, that kind of thing, passes for wit in Verrieres. Julian had already risen. Everybody else got up as well, in defiance of decorum. Such is the power of genius. Madame Valenod kept him another quarter of an hour. He really must hear the children say their catechisms. These were full of the most amusing confusions, of which only he was aware. He prevented himself from pointing them out. "What ignorance of the first principles of religion," thought he. At last he bowed and believed he might escape, but he must endure a fable by La Fontaine. "This author is truly immoral," remarked Julian to Madame Valenod. "In one of his fables, the one on Messire Jean Couturat, he presumes to pour scorn on that which is highly venerable." Venerable. "It has been most strongly censured by the best commentators." Before he left, Julian received 4 or 5 invitations to dinner. "This young man does the department honour," with his wine-flown fellow diners shouted all at the same time. They went so far as to talk of a grant to be voted out of municipal funds to enable him to continue his studies in Paris. While this rash notion echoed around the dining room, Julian had nimbly reached the outer door. "Ah, the scum," he whispered to himself 3 or 4 times in succession, taking pleasure in breathing the fresh air. At that moment he felt completely aristocratic. He, who for so long had been so offended by the patronizing smirk and complacent superiority he thought to lie behind all the politeness he was offered at Monsieur de Renal's. He could not help feeling the great difference. "Even if we forget," he said to himself as he walked along, "that it is a matter of money stolen from the poor, and that then they are even forbidden to sing. Even then would Monsieur de Renal take it into his head to tell his guests the price of each bottle of wine he is offering them, and this Monsieur Valenod, going over the list of his possessions to which he eternally returns, cannot speak of his house, his estate, etc., when his wife is there without saying, 'Your house, your estate.' That lady, apparently so conscious of the joy of possessions, had just made a frightful scene during dinner with a servant who had broken a stemmed glass and spoiled some of her sets of 12, and the servant had replied with an utmost insolence. What a crew, said Julian to himself. They could give me half of what they have stolen, and even then I wouldn't live with them. One day I would forget myself. I wouldn't be able to stop myself expressing the scorn they make me feel. Nevertheless, it was necessary, following Madame de Renal's orders, to attend numerous dinners of the same kind. Julian was fashionable. He was forgiven his guard of honour's uniform, or rather, that daring episode that was the real cause of his success. Soon the great question in Verrieres was to see who would win the contest to secure the services of this learned young fellow, Monsieur de Renal, or the director of the poorhouse. With Monsieur Maslon, these gentlemen had formed a triumvirate that had tyrannized the town for a number of years. People were jealous of the mayor, and liberals had things to complain of. But, after all, he was a nobleman and born to rule, whereas Monsieur Valenod's father had not left him an income of 600 livres. With him, one had to pass from the pity inspired by the shabby apple-green coat by which everyone knew him in his youth, to envy for his normal Norman horses, his gold chains, his suits sent down from Paris, for his current prosperity. In the eddies of this world so new to him, Julian believed he had found one worthy man. He was a geometrician called Gros, who was believed to be a Jacobin. Julian, who had sworn never to affirm anything except what seemed to him false, was forced to behave as though he had his suspicions about Monsieur Gros. He received great bundles of children's work from the Vergy. He had been advised to see his father frequently, and conformed to this melancholy necessity. In a word, he was rebuilding his reputation pretty well, when one morning he was much surprised to find himself awoken by a pair of hands being pressed over his eyes. It was Madame de Renal, who had come to town on a visit. All right, there we go. Pause for today. Thank you very much for listening to this first half of chapter 22. I will see you tomorrow.